You're listening to We Are STS, a podcast from the Department of Science and Technology Studies at University College London. Hi, everybody, and welcome back to We Are STS. I'm your host, Professor Joe Kane. This is another bonus episode. We have lots of traditions here in STS. One is to invite a new member of staff to give the last research seminar in the term. That's a time of celebration for us. And the idea is to give a platform for introducing a new colleague, not just to everyone in STS, but also across the whole academic community here at UCL. There's always a big crowd and always a friendly audience. This year, we invited Dr. Michelle Wahome to continue this tradition. Michelle is lecturer in science, technology, and society. She earned a master's degree in science and environmental policy. She earned a PhD from the University of Edinburgh for a study of digital startup entrepreneurs in Nairobi, Kenya. I think of Michelle as an anthropologist of innovation and policy development. She's especially interested in the ways technical and scientific knowledge mixes together with prevailing ideas in a community. How does this mixing happen? How can it be improved? And what causes disruption to that mixing process? Michelle's especially interested in how this mixing works across the Global South, and she'll explain some of that in her talk. This talk was recorded over Zoom. We picked things up just after Michelle's introduction. You're going to hear Professor Jack Stilgo hand over to Michelle to start her talk.
So, Michelle, let me hand over to you. It's all yours.
Okay, thanks, Jack. So this presentation is based on a project I was working on for 2 years or so, beginning in May of 2019. I was hired as a research fellow for this project. And I'll be talking about scientific research for development. I left the title quite broad so that I could have a think about specifically what it is I wanted to talk about today. I've been writing a paper, co-writing a paper with the project manager for this project that's due on Friday. So I tied all of those things together. And let's see. Next. Okay. So the outline for the talk, I'll begin by setting the scene, discussing a little bit about theories and methods that I use for this paper and also other ideas that I've been developing around this topic. Then I'll go into some of the observations I made and then open up to discussion. I have timed it to be around an hour discussion. Me speaking, and then we can have a discussion all together after that. Let me know if I go too long, because I could tell this story forever. And if you can't hear me, if there's any issue, just feel free to let me know. So the topic, broadly speaking, is about how narrative infrastructure can be a device for facilitating transdisciplinary collaboration. So I'll define all of these things as we go along, and how this can help projects, these sort of collaborative development projects, to engineer success and impact, and maybe in the process of doing that, legitimate marginalized perspectives. So some background. We'll all be familiar with how funding regimes operate. There's a bidding process, a proposal writing process, where we generate heightened expectations. And there's this promissory arena that's created by the funding guidelines, as well as expectations that are generated in the proposal. So in response to those guidelines, those who are writing the grant will seek to excite those who will be assessing the proposal by generating particular kinds of expectations. And then projects will require some sort of inbuilt mechanism to allow the funder to know that the promises are being kept, right? And so this is an arena that's generally managed by the funder through ongoing evaluation. So depending on the size of the project, maybe some of these factors don't exist. But for this particular project, this was definitely how the promissory arena was constructed and how it was run. So the funder put us through ongoing evaluation to make sure that the project was on track to deliver on its promises. So the One Ocean Hub project, when it was funded, was one of 12 UKRI Grand Challenge Research Fund hubs. And they were given £18 million to transform ocean governance. That was the headline. We're talking about narrative infrastructure, the title of the narrative would be Transforming Ocean Governance. In 2020, there were about 124 individuals. They started with around 80. And then those people involved in the project grew to about 124. There were 7 academic institutions in 5 countries. And it's important to note that this funding came from ODA funds, so Overseas Development Assistance. There are legislative mandates behind this, commitments that the UK government has made to the OECD. And that funding was then passed through BASE, which is the Business, Energy and Industrial Strategy Department of the UK government. And then through BASE to NERC, UKRI's NERC. So this ODA fund was traditionally managed by DFID, or what was known as DFID back then. And in 2019, Theresa May's government provided an increased role for BASE. And all of these factors are important to note because they contribute to what I'm calling the narrative infrastructure for this project and what kinds of promises the project had to make and seem to deliver on. So what is narrative infrastructure? It's a concept developed by Deuton and Ripp in a 2000 paper. And they're discussing how managers of technology development, so like software development and other forms of technologies, how they resort to explaining the product development process using a dominant narrative infrastructure about how this takes place. So, you know, these ideas about crossing the valley of death when you're talking about technology production and how investment contributes to production. So there's this embedded narrative in that the managers will reproduce rather than reflecting on the realities of how the process is actually unfolded. So it's only when they're encouraged to reflect on how things actually happened that they veer from the dominant discourse and then elaborate on processes that are non-linear and very nuanced and contingent to their particular contexts. And so Deuton and Ripp say narrative infrastructure can be seen as the rails along which multi-actor and multi-level processes gain trust and direction. I need to move something. Yes. So narrative infrastructure is a mechanism for embedding norms about processes and coordinating all these actors in a large-scale complex project. Given the promissory arena, which I described previously, narrative infrastructure can constrain and enable particular definitions of success and the processes for getting there, and the nature of evidence and ways of knowing that we are being successful. And the most important piece of this in, you know, what makes it an infrastructure is it also defines and determines where and to whom resources are allocated. So my research methodology was as I went in. So I arrived a couple of months after the project had been funded. And in the job description, they had specifically requested a post-colonial STS research fellow. And I was like, that's me. During the interview, I expressed, you know, my misgivings and skepticism around development work. And these were generally well received. And I assumed that I'd be conducting an ethnography of this project as it went along. And I had a few questions that I had at the outset, but as things proceeded, it became clear that it was more, I would have to rely more on grounded theory. It became more of an action research project. I put a question mark because I think that action researchers generally know that they will be doing action research when they start a research project. But this is how things turned out rather than how I had designed my research from the outset, right? I have generally a critical social science perspective. Like I mentioned, post-colonial science and technology studies. And with respect to this particular project, I was also interested in the sort of sociology of expectations and how agency is developed, specifically in this case, in a network of researchers and actors. And Deuton and Rip talk about that a little bit in their paper. And my theory of power is from Barnes. So his idea around power is that it's discretion over others, you know, freedom to decide what should happen in a particular situation. And this means that Barnes kind of has a generous reading of how power operates. So he will often say that the collective has power because it confers authority to certain actors. You know, some of us may be more cynical about that, about the collective having, you know, power because it's conferring authority. But this definition does allow room to think about how power can change depending on the context. And I will talk a little more about this, and it will be evident as the project goes along, or as I describe how the project proceeded. And there's also this idea of power as legitimation of expertise, knowledge, culture. You may be familiar with this idea as decolonizing, whether it's knowledge or decolonizing in general. But I wanted to be clear, you know, when I said decolonizing, what it is I meant, it's shifting who holds the power to legitimate in these particular areas. So data sources, participant observation with heavy emphasis on the participant, documents. So there's lots of documents that are generated by projects of this kind, you know, starting with a call all the way to reports about what's going on. I kept a field diary, if I could remember to do so. But I was generally jotting in a diary every day, whether it was a to-do list or just my thoughts on how things were going. I administered an annual questionnaire every year for all Hub participants. It allowed us to develop our findings in monitoring the Hub and its impact, and we reported some of that data back to the funder. And out of those 124 people, there were some who were more, there were some I kind of viewed as the usual suspects. They were core actors, and others who sort of were more peripheral, and those I targeted with interviews to kind of get a feel for how there was, you know, things were proceeding with them for that, you know, purpose of monitoring for the Hub, but also for my own research interests. So the question for the paper that's due on Friday is can narrative infrastructure be useful for evaluating a project and managing it in the face of complexity? So I'm co-authoring that with the program manager of the project, Joanne Pitt. And she was basically a key respondent. So it felt her contribution to the research was such that it would have, I felt it would have been weird to sort of write about her experience rather than include her as a co-author. And so here we are arguing that narrative infrastructure, even though, it can be viewed from the perspective of, it oversimplifies what should be seen as a complex process, that actually that oversimplification can be really useful for reducing complexity and telling a story about how 124 people working together and collaborating together on a science research project that also should have social implications. The caveat for that we realized is that narrative infrastructure could not become the objective, but these projects had a tendency to objectify the infrastructure, this narrative, and focus on it rather than on any action that might emerge from that. And a side question, and one that I'm thinking about how I can construct into a paper, is can it facilitate alternative imaginaries around how to do this kind of work? So a more decolonized perspective. Is there an appetite, and what kind of incentives would you have to put in place in order to achieve that? Or the question, and the overall question, is can you do both? And that's a theme that kept coming up because of the various interests within the hub to do one or the other or to do both. So the first question is this idea of reducing complexity. So it's important to know that the GCRF funding regime is itself an enactment of another narrative or another narrative infrastructure, and that's the grand challenge narrative infrastructure. So the grand challenges rhetoric was mobilized in early 2000s in the US, and it was in response to a shrinking in policy interest and therefore investment in academic scientific research. So it was a strategic development of a narrative by various actors. Also think around the big science agenda, this idea of doing big science to have social outcomes. And the goal was to persuade decision makers that academic science and innovation can be a tool for resolving difficult social problems and generating innovations for society. So the goal was to revive that kind of 1940s, 1930s, like Vannevar Bush era of Manhattan Project, and having science be entwined with policy making. Often there are lots of incentives to legitimize and reproduce that kind of master narrative and validate it through multiple case examples. And so that incentive was really inbuilt into the grand challenges rhetoric. Those who developed it were highly incentivized to demonstrate that it's true. And it worked to some extent, or to actually a very great extent, because GCRF is actually evidence that that kind of thinking has taken hold and is being implemented. So as Calvert says, the grand challenge label indicates that a policy decision has been made that a particular area of research is deserving of funding. So along with this grand challenge model, the hubs had to also internalize development as an aim and as a goal of the project. And this is ideas of development that reflect dominant notions of progress, you know, a particular kind of economic development, and that science and technology facilitate catch up. So developing countries need to catch up with more affluent nations, and they can do this through innovation and that sort of thing. And it also incorporates this view of science as Western, so connected to a geography rather than a period of time. So science, you can also think of it as a contemporary way of understanding the world. But it, within the idea of development is this notion that it was established in a particular place and other places don't have science. And so it's evident in this kind of one-way, unidirectional notion of how knowledge can be transferred, right? So knowledge transfer, technology transfer is usually conceived in one particular direction, and embedded within that ideas around, you know, saving and, you know, some parts of the world, dollar a day, all of these things are all sort of kind of entwined in all of that. And so once the UKRI was given ODA money, they had to develop their own frameworks for talking about this. So, you know, they're a research funder for academic institutions. How do they start talking about development in a way that resonates with their own interests? So from their website, they spoke about supporting research that addresses the challenges faced by developing countries and develops science and innovation partnerships that promote the economic development and welfare of collaborating countries. So economic development and welfare is specifically tied to the goals of ODA. That's their language now being sort of reflected by UKRI. And GCRF essentially was turning academic researchers into development practitioners. And by holding such large pots of money, there was a great incentive to characterize yourself that way. Rather than just being an academic, you are also a person who was able to achieve impact in social realms. So the GCRF hubs specifically, who were going to receive really big pots of money, had to illustrate that they were transformative. So everything in quotes is from the call. So they had to demonstrate they were going to be transformative, that they were going to resolve intractable challenges, that they'd be challenge-led, interdisciplinary, that they would lead to capacity strengthening both in the UK and in the development assistance country, that their partnerships would be equitable and that these networks would be global, and that in their proposals, they should illustrate how their activities would lead to economic development and well-being or progress on the sustainable development goals. So here is the GCRF theory of change, as it is called. And this is a visualization and infographic that captures GCRF's narrative infrastructure. So how it saw itself as being able to achieve particular kinds of net impacts, who would be involved and where. And so the hubs and other academic projects would be located in the first column. So the initial research and innovation activities. And then the rest of the columns, which are kind of blurry, then suggest how you go from research projects to the kind of impact that GCRF envisioned. So as you will see, this kind of development of a theory of change or a pathway to impact was something that the funder began to require of projects after it had had a round of funding and maybe realized that the stories that are told in at the proposal stage need to be fleshed out and clarified much more clearly, you know, in a much more robust manner. And so the projects began having to develop similar theories of change. So, yes, so the infrastructure for alignment and compliance with GCRF, I've mentioned the evolving guidelines, was this monitoring, evaluation, and learning aspect of operating the projects. And so I mentioned that I arrived having a particular expectation of you, what I would be doing, but when MEL, as it's called, became such a core piece of the project, there was a sense that the responsible research and innovation fellow clearly should be doing MEL. It sounds like something that falls under that umbrella. And so the project manager and I became the MEL people. And as I said, GCRF was committed to this theory-based evaluation approach, that where you develop a theory of change of activities to outcomes. And then we would also be the ones to report on research excellence. So say how the project was innovative and cutting edge and produce the evidence for that, as well as demonstrate how it was being impactful in that framing of ODA, of economic development and well-being. So we'd have to talk about how we were adhering to the GCRF's key principles, as well as the UK government's legislation around gender equality, produce a narrative around that impact and value for money and effectiveness. And all of these were guidelines that were evolving over time. So initially, it's tell us about key principles in gender equality. And then in a few months, and this was, as I mentioned before, various institutional agendas, BASE became very interested in the concept of value for money and effectiveness. And then those interests kind of trickle down to the projects and we're to generate evidence around those topics. So I arrived, as I mentioned, after the project had been funded, and I whipped out my notebook to begin the ethnography, and the first person I spoke to was a project manager, and she was talking about how much difficulty she was having sort of implementing this abstract vision that had been crafted for the proposal, this transforming ocean governance. What does that mean? What are people supposed to do? Of course, those who contributed to the production of the proposal had ideas about what it is they intended and what they saw, how they saw their research fitting in. But it wasn't really a shared vision. So there were multiple actors with multiple interpretations. They had done previous research and had ideas about what the next piece of that would be. And they were all, everyone was very convinced by the buzzwords that had been used, you know, intractable challenges and doing it equitably and partnering well. But in general, in practice, that did not really reflect those buzzwords. And that wasn't always an issue with their, you know, attitudes. It was also time. Do you have the time to take all of these things into account? Or is it just much easier to work as you have always done, right? For me, you know, given my interest, I was very interested in how decolonization was being deployed within the project. There was, once they were told, well, we have to monitor you and submit this data to the funder, there was a lot of talk about how that was very colonial, a very colonial perspective. And for me, it was interesting to see who was making that claim. Sure, they were located in DAC countries, but in terms of their individual identities, they were often you know, leaders of or heads of faculty and that kind of thing. So they were quite elite individuals. And even in terms of racial or ethnic identity, they were not from marginalized groups or even marginalized groups within those countries. So it was almost as if decolonization was being deployed to prevent a shift in power rather than you know, to bring about the inclusion of marginalized voices, right? So for me, this was a very interesting outcome. And I was also interested at the scale at which it was being used. So is, you know, if within a project can, what does decolonization mean? Is it a sort of a micro scale? Is there a micro scale way of applying it, or is it something that is we can only reference at the level of systems and systemic change? Anyway, that's an aside conversation, but it was interesting to me.
I'm going to interrupt here. Let's take a short break. Hey, here's a thought. Maybe you want to move into science communication as a career. If that's the case, have a look at our brand new master's degree in science communication. It's a mix of practical and theoretical. We're bringing in industry professionals to keep us on the cutting edge, and we're mixing together familiar stuff in communication, like broadcasting, journalism, and publishing, with other key parts of the subject, such as communication for policy and campaigning, engagement to boost marginalized voices, and communications work in industry. We're packing a lot in, so give it a look online. We have open days coming up soon, so you can meet staff and ask your questions. Let's get back to the seminar. Remember, this is Dr. Michelle Wahome talking in the STS Research Seminar Series. The title of her talk is Scientific Research for Development.
So, this issue of the narrative infrastructure becoming an object of the project rather than the activities that were, you know, the promises that were made, was something that was very evident to me as the newbie who's arrived with sort of fresh eyes. I arrived when they were preparing the code of practice for how they would work together or how we would work together. And this insistence on equity by the funder and by the researchers themselves led to a codification of what they thought that meant. But once that was done, it was almost as if we've done the equity bit. So there was a sort of a stasis that occurs. And from my perspective, and Bridget and Lely, is that equity should not be understood as a state, but as an attitude that requires continuous reflection. But due to that sort of stasis that occurred, the tensions that had developed at the proposal phase, which I was not privy to, sort of kept recurring and carrying over. It became clear that the role of STS, as it had been envisioned by those who had created this research fellowship, was that it would somehow adjudicate this physical science and social science divide that had apparently developed from the proposal writing phase. So, you know, some of my first interactions was where a request to present or to talk to people about how to reverse the sort of tyranny of the natural sciences or the physical sciences. There was also an idea and a discussion around a group of deep sea scientists who had been nicknamed the Boys from the North, and they had ended up having very large funding allocations. Deep sea science is quite expensive, but there had been an expectation that they would then share, have placements for Global South scientists on their cruises, teach them how to use particular kinds of tools and devices and that sort of thing. But that wasn't happening, or the discussion around that wasn't going as well as people had hoped. And so there was the hope that somehow STS understandings would resolve these issues, right? So it was obvious that there needed to be a shared internal narrative infrastructure. So not only referencing the expectations that had been developed externally, but developing one that was internal that could guide how people worked together and what they actually did. And so I asked, was this an opportunity for Praxis? Since there's this push for STS to actually do something, is this an opportunity to see whether it can? And Joyton and Rip also talk about the tension between postmodern epistemologies and action. And so it's like, maybe this is a chance, as a researcher to also research this bit of things. So this section is kind of an example because I wanted to make concrete how these tensions were playing out. So there were social scientists, scholar activists who were very interested in decolonial praxis, and I think had a lot to do with the development of a fellowship around RRI and STS and that sort of thing. Or, so they had all envisioned what this kind of the fellowship would do. And there was a sense that equity meant a reversal of hierarchy. So rather than evening the playing field, there was this sense that social science and marginalized voices would now become the powerful ones. And so a play had been written that was based on a methodology called empathetheater, and which uses ethnography to gather ideas and then sort of have those ideas coalesce into a screenplay. And then there's the play reveals what the ethnography and interviews and all sorts of things had produced. And so in the play, one of the characters was a scientist, and she was quite sad for most of the play. And in the end, her partner ends up committing suicide because of the effects of science on the world, or, and how their science was being used by policymakers and that sort of thing. And you can imagine the response to this was quite mixed. But yes, there was this sense that somehow science was in cahoots with exploitation, particularly of marginalized groups. And I remember watching it, and I was writing my notes, and I was like, for me, the problem was that it was tied to understandings of what has gone wrong in the past without suggesting what could be done instead. And I couldn't see how that would actually facilitate collaboration within the project. And the conversation around it was quite fraught and led to very many changes to the script. But anyway, so it was very revealing, as a person who's just arrived, of what is happening and how some people feel. And I also wanted to reflect that a year later, after some changes had been made, it was a touring play. So other than being presented to within the hub, it also went around to other parts of South Africa specifically. And it didn't just have a scientist as a character. There were other characters who were reflecting how they felt about oceans and what the ocean meant to them and its utility for them and how they felt about exploitation of it and stewardship of it. So a year later, a group of a fisheries cooperative in South Africa had watched it, and one of their leaders, when asked what he thought of it, you know, his reflection was that scientific knowledge is not the enemy. And what his main interest in was to understand how the government and the petroleum agency, PASA, was thinking. So he was like, I need to understand what their interests are and why they are making the decisions they are making. So I don't really understand what's going on here. And his reflection was essentially that scientific knowledge was not the enemy. So this essentially is a site to sort of show how the counter narrative was also in some ways becoming the object of the project. You know, so those who could have benefited from our activities were also still being left out, even though there was a sense that hierarchies were being reversed or the play itself was a reflection of decolonial practice. It was still internal to the hub, you know, resolving issues that were within the hub and still all broader ideas about whose knowledge is legitimate or isn't. But that wasn't at all useful to the people that the project claimed to be interested in. So this awareness, as I said, that there needed to be a shared vision and a shared narrative infrastructure within the group was obvious to everyone, and various tools and devices for talking about this came up. We had frequent meetings, all hub meetings, which were called online living aulas. And an aula is a specific kind of get together. We had tried to structure those meetings in that way. Again, as part of this effort to decolonize the project. So the idea was that this golden thread process would be very different from the monitoring and evaluation and learning required by UKRI, which, like I said, some viewed as colonial. And so instead, we were going to pioneer a new process that wasn't colonial. The issue was that the UKRI did not want a golden thread. They wanted a theory of change. So they wanted us to cast our activities using that framework, and that's it. Everything else can be appendices in the appendix section, but we needed the theory of change. And given that the RRI fellow, me, had been tasked with that, I had my own interests now tied into the production of a theory of change. And I wasn't averse to it. It seemed a fairly neutral tool to me. So I note from the field diary of that particular meeting that the program manager and I thought it would be useful to illustrate how the theory of change can be used as a tool for thinking and planning and connecting one's research. And so I was going to demonstrate that I was a convert to it, having never heard of it before either, but that I found it neutral and that sort of thing. And so I had prepared a talk that I was going to give to everyone and to convince them of the value of doing this thing that we had to do anyway. And so I said that as social science researchers, we are often applying theories of social change to our analyses. and this monitoring, evaluation, and learning and theories of change, they're just a process of directly locating our research within processes of social change. So now going from abstractions to specifics, I was trying to characterize it that way. And so we are generating hypotheses about how our research can affect, can generate impact, still aware that, you know, the impact agenda is kind of problematic more generally, but trying to get everyone to get behind this concept because of, like I said before, there was a promissory arena that had been created, and now we were active participants within it. So the respondents of a group that self-selected to participate in MEL were like, okay, fine. You know, one person was like, what are the methodologies? How do we do this properly? Someone else said we needed to collate what's already been done in with respect to oceans and development in all countries. And then after that, rather than, you know, reinventing the wheel, the priorities should be set by Melanesian spearheaded groups. So this was someone who was from a partner from the Pacific Islands. Another respondent was like, we want alternatives, and the alternatives are not yet apparent in what you are telling us. Someone else had nothing to say. And the respondent number five was like, we have to do both. And another person had a useful comment. All of them were very useful, was that we'll have to develop impact case studies. So let's work backwards to figure out what we hope the impact will be and then think about activities that can lead us there. But I focus in on the we have to do both idea because it connects to that notion I had of, you know, perhaps this is an opportunity for praxis of some of these theoretical, you know, ideas we have around what decolonization looks like and how do you actually do it. So this brings us to the second bit, or the second question that I had, which was, can you use narrative infrastructure to develop alternative imaginaries? So to think about alternatives, I think it's important to broaden the context of development practice, and I guess by broadening it, I mean looking at it from the way I see it and how other decolonial scholars might see it, how people on the ground might view it. And is that development generally occurs in a context of a history of colonial relationality, right? So the countries that are being developed are ones that were colonized often by the ones that are seeking to help, right? And this is also occurring in a context of capitalism. And so there's globalization by large companies and the capital flight that follows, where they don't necessarily pay the rate of tax that might be fitting. And an important point is that migrant remittances, so the money that's sent back by people who've migrated from developing countries, is often three, it's not often, it's actually three times in 2019, more than all countries spend on ODA, so overseas development assistance, and in foreign direct investment. So all that money that ODA in the world represents, and all the money that comes from more commercial interests, if you multiply that by three, then you have the amount of money that people send back to their families. And so perhaps a solution would be maybe opening borders rather than having all these projects. But anyway, I digress. So this is something that I always remembered, because the idea of, you know, the taxpayer and how the taxpayer's money is being spent was one that kept coming up as a way of policing ideas about how money could be used, right? And 18 million pounds is really a lot of money. And everyone kept thinking of that in terms of value for money. What is it doing? And in the back of my mind, I would think of this number of, you know, how much migrant remittances is relative to, you know, this idea of ODA being reflective of the generosity of nations to one another and that sort of thing. And also the aid industry is quite professionalized. So when you think of who benefits from the continuation of it, there's a lot of people who are employed with it, in it, lots of international organizations. And so it's not just a particular group of actors who benefit from the existence of a development practice, right? And that was something that is often forgotten in these discussions. And overall effectiveness is still an open question. It's difficult to evidence a counterfactual, obviously, like if we hadn't intervened then, or if people were allowed to develop in their own, sort of the capabilities approach, if it was left to people to decide what their freedom looked like or what development looked like, that might be better than. It's difficult to make the case either way. But these are all open questions, right? And it's also important to know that even as we advocate for global networks, that these transnational corporations and collaborations don't occur in neutral zones. Essentially, when you bring people together, you create an arena where negotiation and power needs to be brokered at all times, and acting as if that's not the case is not really helpful. There's always an unequal distribution of decision-making and accountability. In this case, because there needs to be a lead institution that's funded, all the accountability is on them. And there was a strong sense with the lead institution of being liable for things not going well, or for being the responsible for success, right? So both sides of that. And then another issue is that prejudices are only revealed retrospectively. No one goes in thinking, oh, I am a biased person. Maybe they do. But even if they do that, it's only the awareness that that's the case only happens after people have started to engage with one another. And there are these cultural orders of knowledge, of which knowledge is best and whose is who's the expert. And those are really difficult to undo, even if you try to do it then with a very controversial play. You can't really change the dominant frameworks through which people understand expertise. And the fears that emerge from this fear of accountability and liability can be expressed in a kind of paternalism to partners. So either being too afraid to ask them to kind of shape up, or too vigilant about their activities. So fear that the corruption in their society is widespread and that they won't use the money the way they're supposed to, and that sort of thing. So all of these things are factors that the narrative infrastructures that are developed for these kinds of projects often elide. They don't put them front and center, that this is what we're actually dealing with and what we have to keep in mind as we proceed. So I mentioned that I was often asked to explain to people, to researchers about, you know, how, what decolonization might mean, and how you know, the Global South partners might view this kind of relationship. And so one time I said, you know, does everyone know the story of the Good Samaritan? And I was like, well, imagine if the Good Samaritan was actually one of the bandits who'd kind of come back to, you know, had the change of heart and now wanted to restore the man to health. If that was the case, how, you know, how do we think of this story now? Like, do you, is he still the good guy, or is the story a little more murky, a little more nuanced? And so this was kind of my way of smoothening the idea of or delivering the idea that Global South partners might view development practice with skepticism, and why that might be the case. And there's reason for this, so it's not just a shyness or reticence that comes from it comes from actual experience. So there are lessons from recent history on alternative views to how development is usually characterized. And so the OECD itself had a sort of reflection in around 2005 and developed new guidelines for how it would be delivering ODA. So it was called the Paris Declaration of Aid Effectiveness. And they said that, you know, ownership would be by the developing countries. They would set their own strategies, improve their own institution, and then donor countries would align behind those objectives and use local systems to deliver. So all these institutions, all these large professionalized spaces would be located in the local countries or in the local context. That there would be more harmonization, so there's no duplication, procedures would be simplified, there would be a heavy emphasis on results rather than on sort of these storylines about development and what it means, and that there'd be a setting of mutual accountability. So this was a new narrative infrastructure that was developed by the OECD. And in 2008, they developed specific actions about how you would actually implement this. But by 2011, the consensus was that this hadn't worked out. And the blame was largely put on the donor countries for the, you know, usually it's the reverse, but the donor countries had not been able to implement these rules for aid effectiveness as well as the developing countries. And for me, this suggests that there's an overarching narrative infrastructure and that this particular infrastructure did not resonate with, and therefore it could not be implemented because there was another narrative that was much stronger and much had more pull and had better incentives. And further history on development and alternative perspectives. So the development banks that were created in the post-war period essentially had been created to repair Europe after World War II. And so that's a very different framing from what they then became. You know, after that issue was kind of solved, the next case of needing to repair was after the countries that were emerging out of the colonial period. But the framing for what the banks were supposed to do became development rather than this sort of reconstruction and repair. And I think an interesting question is what that change in framing then translates into. And the Komarovs and Achille Bembe have this idea of theorizing from the South, where they suggest that developing countries, global South countries, represent the outcomes of sort of global capitalism and the direction in which it's going. Developing countries, rather than being behind, actually indicate what the rational outcome of that sort of development is. And so that's an idea they have. And, you know, as we watch, you know, the current attitudes of the IMF and World Bank, how they deal with all countries these days, sort of a tendency towards advocating for austerity and that sort of thing. It's one can wonder whether it's their experience with how they dealt with developing countries, particularly in the 80s, whether that's reflected back on the attitudes they have to global economies more generally. Another aside, but one that I also think is interesting.
Can you wrap up, Michelle? Sorry, yes. We've got to that.
Okay, so... So, yes, all that to say that the narrative infrastructure that we needed to develop needed to have that idea of doing both, of being able to reflect the need within the hub for a decolonized perspective, but also resonating with the overarching narrative infrastructure that we had to comply with. And we can see from the past history of development narrative infrastructures that if you don't resonate with the overarching dominant story, that you might not be successful. So these are some of the ideas that informed the infrastructure that we did develop within the hub. And we ensured that it was tied to action. And this was facilitated by the fact that there was a flexible fund within the hub that allowed money to be spent at will. So it had not been allocated to particular things. So from that, we were able to pay for actors who weren't necessarily professionally connected to the hub to participate. We tried to devolve leadership from the lead institution to country-led management, a country-led management approach. And our theory of change, which you, if you had time, could look through, incorporated those ideas while still tying to the GCRF theory of change that I mentioned earlier. It came to research. We developed these main themes under which researchers could locate their own research. So we did a survey of what everyone was doing, and we said these are the four main thematic areas that you can fit yourself under. It allows us to meet the goals of the funder while also meeting with our own expectations for what it is that we are doing. The response to this was that it was mostly a question of individual buy-in. So this sort of physical science, social science divide was not evident to me. It was mostly a question of academic culture and the incentives within it. And some people felt that they could not switch too far away from, you know, what their disciplines and what their academic agenda was. And that didn't necessarily rhyme with being country-led. And so they preferred to focus within their own research programs and develop their own groups that way. When the power to change their minds did not exist, so they sort of developed their own things. And the pull to objectify the infrastructure was always there. The projects that we highlighted to the funder tended not to be the ones that had any incorporated some of these ideals. One of the ones we talked about the most was Biodiscovery for Cancer Research. The odds of developing pharmacological outputs from this piece of the research are slim to none. However, that's the kind of narrative that was interesting, most interesting to the funder, and we're always encouraged to frame critique as opportunities and that sort of thing. And to be visible, to be seen, to be operating in an international governance arena, even though that did not necessarily have the impact that had been implied by the project. So I wanted to end on a positive note by highlighting that within that there was a group called the Deep Knowing Group that really represented these ideas around transdisciplinarity as being beyond discipline, that included non-academic actors, that reflected broader thinking. And they were very interested in taxonomy, a scientific taxonomy, as a way of bringing together various kinds of knowledge. And by working together, some of the serendipitous outcomes was that they were able to involve fisher folk in decision-making in marine spatial planning at a national level, which was unprecedented and was actually one of the major stories that we did provide to the funder. At the decision-making level, members of our executive team noted that they had changed, they themselves had changed, at a meeting at the UK government Ocean Decade, where they had been called in as experts. They reflected a more holistic perspective and in fact were asked to present to others on how they felt social science could be incorporated into deep sea research. And they kept using themselves as kind of their own examples of how useful it is and that sort of thing. And, you know, one of the action items at the end of that meeting was that now we needed to frame the hub through the imperatives of Ocean Decade that the UK government was developing at that time and develop a whole other narrative infrastructure. But so there were pluses, minuses, and overall it was an interesting project to be involved in. I really would like to, you know, in the future, think through this idea of what SDS praxis is. I had to do it. It wasn't something that I was expecting to do, but I think it would be a useful thing to think about and around. So with that, I come to the end and open to discussion.
Thanks, Michelle. Well done.
Well, that's our show for today. What a great introduction to Michelle and her research. Welcome to STS, Michelle. We're so glad you're here. Folks around STS will know Michelle's already busy teaching and mentoring. She's been a big hit with our master's students. And she's been making her mark in our undergraduate programs, too. Michelle's talk included a PowerPoint presentation, and I'll put links to that presentation in the show notes, along with links to more of Michelle's work. We Are STS is a production of the Department of Science and Technology Studies at University College London. If you're wondering more about our degrees and teaching, just get in touch. We're always happy to talk. That includes asking about our brand new master's degree in science communication. We are red hot excited about this degree, folks, and I bet it's gonna be big. Music today included two pieces from Kevin MacLeod, Roland at 5, and Ecossais in E flat. Kevin, you're brilliant. Thanks for making these available. Both pieces are available from the website filmmusic.io. Finally, you can find out more about the show, tell us what you think, and explore more of our programs just by visiting our website. Here's the address, so write it down. It's ucl.ac.uk/sts/podcast. That's it for today. Thanks for coming along, everybody. Till next time, I'm Professor Joe Kane, and remember that together we are STS. Bye now. You've been listening to We Are STS, a podcast from the Department of Science and Technology Studies at University College London. Subscribe to the show and join us online. The address, ucl.ac.uk/STS/podcast.